On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for September 7th, 2017, the DACA Attacka edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine is here in D.C. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David. So glad to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. And John Dickerson is back and is also here in D.C. Hello, John. Where are you back from?
Oh, man. I'm so happy to be back. I'm back from Ireland, which is...
Oh, that's right. I forgot going there. Was it really lovely?
Oh, it was great. The west coast of Ireland, all the people. I can't thank the entire country of Ireland enough for all the good things it did for me and my family.
That's so great.
That's amazing. Oh, I'm very jealous.
I think that Atlas Obscura should have an Ireland correspondent. Everywhere you turn, there is wonder and, everywhere you turn.
And someone speaking with the best accent ever.
Yes, and like, I know. You can spend a day having a conversation about Pete. And if they don't have an Ireland correspondent, I would like to be an Ireland correspondent.
That can be your next job when you're tired of facing the nation. You can face the ocean. On this week's Gabfest, President Trump ends DACA, kinda, sorta, in a maximally heartless, minimally effective kind of way. Then, have President Trump and the Democrats just broken the legislative logjam that Congress faced in September? And then, can North Korea be stopped? Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And of course, we have an announcement about our live shows. On October 25th, in Chicago, at the Merle Reskin Theater, we will be doing a live Gabfest. Going to be a great show.
We're working on a super awesome guest.
We have a super awesome guest we're expecting
to
have.
Maybe we'll get to announce that next week.
You may want to preemptively buy your tickets just to make sure you get to see that super awesome guest. So October 25th, live in Chicago. Please join us. It's going to be a super show. And then in Boston on December 6th, we do one of our favorite shows of the year, our Conundrum Show. We're going to do that live at the Wilbur Theater. Again, tickets at slate.com/live. And that has a special double bonus, which is that you get a They Might Be Giants concert thrown in for free. They Might Be Giants is going to be our house band for the night, and they're going to open for us and then play throughout the show appropriately, play appropriate songs appropriate for the conundrums that you're going to be posing. So,
can we take out the word appropriate? I feel like it's such an unfun word, and you're describing such a fun event. Fitting.
Yeah,
how about that?
It'll be inappropriate. Hopefully, they'll be inappropriate, but they'll be fitting. They're going to be fun. Those guys are just lively as the Dickens, and it's going to be incredibly great sharing a stage with them. So again, tickets at slate.com/live. We hope to see you in Chicago and in Boston, maybe both. President Trump and his rather gleeful Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded the deferred action on childhood arrivals, the 2012 Obama policy that allowed undocumented aliens brought to the U.S. as children, folks who had lived exemplary lives, to work and live in the U.S. without fear of deportation. The president didn't exactly end it so much as he introduced massive uncertainty into it. DACA will gradually slide out of favor, out of legality. New applicants are no longer being accepted. And starting in March 2018, DACA status holders are much more eligible for deportation unless Congress acts, which is what the president urged them to do. Emily, so the president claimed that he had to do this because it had been an illegal executive action and they were about to get sued. Is that true?
Well, no, not in any literal sense, but it's also not wildly made up in the sense that when President Obama, after President Obama signed the order for DACA, he also expanded it to include parents and other close family members of the Dreamers. And that order was challenged in court, and the Obama administration lost at the Fifth Circuit. This is a decision that the Supreme Court then split 4-4 about, affirming the Fifth Circuit decision but not issuing its own opinion. And the logic of the Fifth Circuit was essentially that the Obama administration had overreached, that this was not a form of acceptable prosecutorial discretion, which is what Obama claimed and what other presidents have done in extending deferred deportation to groups of people, like domestic violence victims, for example. So instead, the judges said, no, you went too far. You created a brand new policy, and you either needed Congress to show up and do this, or at the very least, you should have done what's called notice and comment rulemaking, which is when you go through the whole kit and caboodle of, like, everyone responding, et cetera. So that's the argument that there was executive overreach here. And what was happening was that 10 Republican state attorneys general were threatening to sue over DACA in the same court that the Obama administration lost in. And apparently, Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, was saying that he wasn't going to defend DACA against that challenge. And that would have put the Trump administration in a political bind. Legally speaking, they could have waged the whole thing as a fight in court. But then you have, you know, Trump somehow having to order some other part of the Justice Department to go around Jeff Sessions to oppose Republican attorneys general.
John, why is the Trump base so eager to end DACA of all things? These are people who are by definition not criminals, who are productive members of society. What is the eagerness to make this an issue?
So as a political maneuver, you could see him rushing into this because he needs a win on something that's important to his base. But this is a little bit more complicated because there was this timing aspect where, and I want to ask you, Emily, about the balance of powers here question. But there was this, it was forced on him a little bit. So if it weren't forced on him, would he have let it go? Because he's got other fish to fry. He's got other stuff going on. And we'll talk about that
and
in another topic.
And he does seem ambivalent.
And he does seem ambivalent. And it's not an issue the way, say, the wall is with his base. Now, look, there, the notion of, I'm not suggesting that the core Trump base, the 35%, is not against DACA, particularly the way in which Obama did it. I mean, that for them actually inflames it a little bit worse, because this is the, like, root of his lawlessness, breaking the rules of the presidency to do what he wants, which we should take an aside and just note that that's actually what they would like the president to do, which is use the power of the presidency to be an action president on behalf of the ideas that they do want. So it gets a little muddled. But so I don't think as a political matter, it's as clean a shot as some other immigration related things. But I mean, generally, to your original purpose, the idea is basically these kids, while they didn't do it themselves, their parents did something illegally and their kids have benefited as a result of it. And why should they get theirs when we're not getting ours?
You know what really interested me about the politics? So Jeff Sessions makes this announcement. He's the go-to person for this for the Trump administration. He gets up and says what he's been saying in the Senate for years. These are illegal aliens. There is nothing compassionate about not enforcing our immigration laws, period, the end. This was Jeff Sessions' identity. One of his primary identities as a politician was to stand with the hard right on immigration. That was not where most of the Republican Party was, right? This is a person who, when he proposed an amendment to the last comprehensive immigration reform, nobody voted for it in committee except for him. He was by himself. Then you have this response. It was pretty bipartisan in its condemnation. Why is that when Congress had failed multiple times to pass Dreamer Act? Because you've now created this class of people and they're productive citizens and they're super sympathetic and most of the country does not really have the heart to expel them, which is what we're talking about doing. Right. People who were raised here, who speak the language, who are Americans in everything but their papers, as Obama said. It's harder to dislodge something than it is never to get it started to begin with. And so whatever you think about Obama's, you know, exercise of power, he has changed the facts on the ground in a way that has changed the politics.
Also, by the way, this notion that Jeff Sessions said, as you quoted, there is nothing compassionate about the failure to enforce immigration laws. Actually, that just doesn't make sense.
No,
of course there is something compassionate. You may say
to that the that people who are not being deported.
Yes, of course. It's like it's the definition of compassion when you give a stay of a law that would hurt somebody. Now, you may argue that that compassion hurts other people and have a yada yada yada, but you can't say that it just isn't without compassion at all. So,
but
that's just
okay. A couple of points. One is, I do think that the worst thing you can do in the world is make someone fearful for no purpose, or to create uncertainty in their life and danger in their life for no purpose, which is what it seems to me that the president is doing with this, or Jeff Sessions is doing with this. On the other hand, Jeff Sessions is right, and the president is right, that Congress has been negligent and derelict in its duty on immigration. The insofar as there are laws on the books, the laws are on the books that Jeff Sessions is trying to enforce. They do say these are people who are not allowed to be here. These are people who are here illegally and have no right of residency and no right to work. And Congress has absolutely refused at every opportunity to legislate and make it possible for people to stay here or change those laws. And the very people who are Republicans and Democrats, mostly Republicans, who are condemning what the president is doing here, failed, voted against legislation in the past, have not taken action, which is their constitutional Article I obligation to act on this. And,
sure.
And so screw them for trying to put it all on Trump or put it all on Sessions. It's on them.
And if they get their act together, then in a sense, Trump will be proved right. It would certainly be better for the Dreamers to have as long as the policy solution is a viable one that lets them stay here legally and is truly compassionate because it's long term. I mean, one of the problems with DACA was that it's 2-year increments, right? Then, Trump would be proved right. I mean, that's a very complicated question whether Congress will get its act together to do that. But there's no question that DACA was a workaround. At the same time, I do think it's important to recognize that if we hadn't had the workaround, we wouldn't be having the groundswell of support for these people that we're having now.
Well, that's what's interesting in terms of the balance of branches and the balance of powers. And when you talked about the notice and comment that the president and the rulemaking notice and comment that the president went around, that was initially created. That notice and comment was created as a way for Congress to say, okay, to the president, you've seized these powers, but we're going to make you put this up for notice and comment. This is
it's
in a previous
period.
It's
going to take forever.
Yeah.
Yes, this
and
is a long time ago.
We want, Congress was trying to scratch back some of its power to at least tinker with something the president was going to do anyway. But so I guess my point is that this is a part of a long story of Congress and the White House balancing and battling for who has the power to do these kinds of things.
In our last and current version of immigration law, Congress
abrogated?
No.
Arrogated.
Hand over power to someone else.
Isn't
it's
it
like obvious? No, the opposite. When you deputize, no. Delegate. Sorry.
Yeah, right.
Congress delegated the federal government to make all these decisions. And it is inevitable that the government cannot try to deport the millions of people who are here. Right. The federal government has to make distinctions about who's a priority and who's not. So in that sense, there was nothing remarkable about DACA, except that it was on a big scale and it was announced ahead of time. And that, set up alarm bells.
Last question on this, John. Will Democrats go for trading Dreamers for the wall? Will they try to come up with something which is like, okay, we'll give you some wall and you just have to put DACA back in place?
I think no. I think their first position will be there's the Dream Act, just passed the Dream Act. Doesn't the Dream Act solve this? This is the Durbin-Graham bill puts a position. I mean, there's legislation there. There's also actually 4 pieces of legislation that were offered before the president.
But they've all.
Yeah, but they also can come up with some border security measure that's not the wall. I think for Democrats, the wall is a hill to die on. I mean, I'll be proved wrong in a month. But I really think that is going to be a tough sell for them.
Well, it's interesting. This will get into our other conversation.
And I'd give the wall for the Dreamers.
But I think the Democrats at the moment don't think they have to give the wall. I think they think that the country is so against this. The president is ambivalent about it. I mean, I think the Democrats feel like they have a position of power here. I do wonder whether, though, in the context of other negotiating that's going on, whether the wall could be used as a chip by the Democrats. You know, we'll talk about the deal the president just decided to make with Schumer and Pelosi over Ryan and McConnell for spending and to keep the government open. And I think the wall could come back in that context.
Interesting.
All right. Coming up, by the way, we have a Slate Plus segment for Slate Plus members. That Slate Plus segment, we're going to talk about the fight over Google and the New America Foundation and whether Google is untowardly influencing public policy and research on the left. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/gabfestplus.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Something really weird happened on Wednesday in Washington. President Trump, in one of his very first meetings ever with Democratic congressional leaders, agreed on the spot to a Democratic plan to tie Hurricane Harvey aid to a 3-month extension of government spending bills and a 3-month extension of the debt ceiling. Republicans who had wanted an 18-month deal at the most or a 6-month deal at the very least were livid.
Well, he did it without even telling them. He totally embarrassed Ryan and McConnell. They're at this meeting. They're like stuck with these frozen grins on their faces. I mean, it's John, I just explain the politics of this to me.
You want me to explain?
Yes.
I think on the one hand, it's quite simple. Well, on the other hand, it's who knows the ways of the minds of the man in the Oval Office. Ryan and McConnell have screwed him recently on a variety of fronts, whether he sees it that way. So he's like, what do I owe you guys? Two, he wants a clean debt ceiling. He wants this Harvey money through. And that's let's get this done and over. And I got other things to worry about. Three, we saw from the campaign and people were expecting, you could see another road the president would have gone down in his presidency if he hadn't launched it in the way he did.
And which was it.
And this was it, which was start with infrastructure, work with Schumer, get a deal with Democrats, like be the third way kind of guy. And it's coming awfully late. There's a lot of, water under the bridge. But and now on Thursday, the president has called Schumer and Pelosi. So
he has. So it's not just been that one meeting.
It wasn't just that one meeting. There were calls.
We don't know Chuck and Nancy. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
We don't know the nature of
the.
We don't know the nature of the conversations yet. But nevertheless, that's what's happening.
He wants to be the deal maker. I think he got tired of all the. I feel like I read 10 articles this week where the deal making president has yet to make a deal, and now he made a deal, and it just so happens that he completely screwed over his own party. Did he not?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's a portion of his party, the conservative portion, by the way. I mean, the portion that he screwed over is the portion that kind of brought him to the dance, which is to say the reason they would feel screwed over is they don't want to see a clean debt ceiling increase. Secondarily, they don't want to see a debt ceiling increase, and these are related, that has Hurricane Harvey relief money tied to it, because their argument is that that makes it a hostage of. The Secretary of Treasury's argument is the reason you have to have the debt ceiling increase to pay for Harvey is that you can't pay for Harvey because the money won't be there with the debt ceiling. Conservatives say, we got to do something about the $20 trillion debt. The debt ceiling is the way to do it. The president, as a candidate, would have agreed with that. The Freedom Caucus in the House agrees with that. But now the president is essentially undermining the Freedom Caucus, and the Freedom Caucus should be, his team. So now the Freedom
Caucus... Wasn't it more than the Freedom Caucus? Hadn't Ryan and McConnell rejected this very deal 3 hours
earlier? Well, the timeline part, yes. They wanted a longer timeline. But they were, in the Senate, they were okay with putting Harvey and the debt limit in the same.
But that's sort of what I don't get about it. It seems like Trump could have worked with the Republicans and gotten more time and something pretty close to this. And instead of giving them the chance to do that, he just ripped the rug out from under them. And I'm just starting to wonder how many times Trump gets to do that to the Republican leadership before they're like, hey.
Well, but if you put yourself in his shoes, he's having his best day in a long time on the congressional front today. Everybody's like, oh, my God,
yes,
the deal
today.
Maker. But what does he need them for? What this suggests to me is tax reform, which was always a huge pipe dream, gone. Because on the other hand, actually, now that I say that, that's not right. Because Republicans want tax reform so
Right.
Badly, they'll come calling back. No matter
So I don't know. I mean, I guess my point with him is it wasn't going very well in the other direction, right? They got no health care. Basically, like, you know, Supreme Court's the best thing. And he owes Mitch McConnell a great deal for that. But other than that, why not try this?
One thing I don't understand, John, is why is this the president? So the president says, I want a 3-month deal. Democrats, I want a 3-month deal. Why does that mean there's a deal? It doesn't mean
McConnell and they still have to introduce the legislation.
Sure. And Paul Ryan, this is where it's going to be. This is where it's gonna be really fascinating to watch. Because so Paul Ryan has to put that deal on the floor and then it would pass.
And then
pass
break the what's it called?
The Hastert rule. Which is really, you know, they would tell you it's not a real rule. It's a norm, which is funny in these days of breaking norms. Anyway, it was when Boehner broke that norm, it was a part of the case against him, which then caused him to ultimately leave. Ryan has to put it on the floor. So you can imagine this. Ryan puts it on the floor based on a deal the president has worked out with the Democrats. It passes, which gives the president his win that he wants in whatever the formula is that's going on in his strategic thinking at the moment. And then Ryan gets savaged by Steve Bannon, the president's former chief strategist, now back at Breitbart, for being a capitulating, you know, a horrible person.
I guess what I also think about the medium to long term of this is 2018. That's the part that I'm surprised. I guess the notion that Trump thinks in the medium to long term or buys any kind of conventional wisdom about it. Like, why should he? He won the campaign ignoring all of it. I guess there's that. But like, if he weakens the party sufficiently that the one house of Congress flips in 2018, like he is going to be really sorry.
Why does this worsen their electoral prospects? I don't think it does, because one thing there, it makes it much less likely the government's going to default, much less likely that there'll be a government shutdown.
So there is that argument that they should thank him and the Democrats for bailing them out, except that if they could have worked this deal out as grownups and were seen to be functioning and the government and they can run it and like, yes, we can, that would be better for them, wouldn't it?
Well, but it's going to be a bipartisan bill. It passes. It'll be a,
I guess.
I mean, yeah. But also what happens in December now?
Yeah, then there's that.
Because this gets us to December.
Right.
So what happens? So December, you still have to do a debt ceiling. You still have to do a real government appropriations bill, spending bill.
Right. Yeah. And we're back here. We're back. This is a snooze bar. I mean, we're back at all those same questions.
But that seems like a smart thing to worry about later if you're the Trump administration, because there'll be different pressures on the Republicans to pass something. And if not, you go make another deal with the Democrats if that doesn't seem to have totally messed things up for you.
Yeah. And he's got they still have these questions to deal with. The Harvey will be out of the way. So then it'll just be, well, by then it might be funding for Irma too, but it'll then just be debt limit and government funding. But of course, then there are all these other bills too that have to be dealt with that we'll get to.
Tax reform, DACA, and the healthcare
FAA,
system.
FAA, right, the FAA. Children's health insurance.
Yeah. Well, so that's what's interesting in this sense, which is these issues are the ones that are constant or in our current politics have become a constant because Congress is incapable of doing the basic functions of their job. And so there are these constant precipice moments because Congress is so dysfunctional. So it's sort of amusing to think then of this other laundry list of things, which are reauthorizations. Now, this is not totally fair. There's some defense reauthorizations that have actually gone through with bipartisan support that Congress has dealt with. So you could imagine actually on something like CHIP, people getting together. Also on healthcare, Alexander and Murray seem to be in terms of shoring up the exchanges and making sure that, although that'll be its own battle. But I guess my point is that if they can't do this, like getting to tax reform is going to be, it's going to be impossible.
Emily, just going back to the psychodynamics of this deal on Wednesday, how much of it do you think is Trump, I want to get a deal? And how much of it is Trump is, as Josh Marshall, I think, wrote in Talking Points memo, is motivated by dominance and the chance to just squash and humiliate Ryan and McConnell. It was in front of him. It sat in front of him. It was right in his face. And he was like, I'm going to take that.
Yeah, it does seem significant. I mean, it's a little hard to say, right? Because also he seemed to have made the decision in like a split second. But yeah, the performance of it added to all of that humiliating dimension, right? That you're actually like taking people unawares, including your own Treasury Secretary. I mean, Mnuchin was also surprised and flabbergasted in the moment. you know, that's great television, right? Like, this is where we go back to the idea that the presidency.
Was it on TV?
No, there were pictures.
Yeah.
Of it,
I meant that it's like a great performance.
But I think that's a better way to say it, which
yes,
is this is great television.
It's reality television that we're watching. It's a soap opera.
And I must say that we should note, this might be a very narrow little moment, and there may never be a second beat of this storyline, but this is what so many of the president's people who knew the president when he was a candidate had said he would do, is that he likes chaos. And the way to be chaotic in Washington would be to scramble the partisanship. And he would be the master of the chaos. And everybody would think, why is he doing it? But he would be the center of the TV show.
That's right.
And instead, he came and ran a super base-oriented. Now, he's still doing a lot of that. So this is not, we're not talking about a pivot here. Make no mistake, anybody listening to this.
But it's a different move.
But it is a different move of the kind that that we've seen. Exactly.
Right. And maybe just the, like, aggro dominance is also about throwing people, keeping people on their toes. And, I mean, he just has zero loyalty to his own party. So all the traditional ties that bind, that would make this unthinkable for any other president I can think of, are just, like, off the table. Because he doesn't care if these people get mad at him. They're already all mad at each other.
Also, we'll see how this plays out. But, I mean, after Charlottesville, a lot of us thought, what Democrat is going to do any kind of deal with the president on anything because of the pain that their base would
inflict
on them for doing a deal with the president. This is a little bit of a special case because it's an emergency thing. But I guess my point is that dynamic, I think, still is in place for any thinking anybody would try to do about, like, whether this is the beginning of a new set of arrangements. But who knows what his response will be to the generally, I think in his eyes, favorable responses from the media coverage, which has been, oh my gosh, the president, like, shakes things up. He's the, you know, he's at the center of this dynamic thing that's happening, which I think for him is a pleasant kind of news coverage to get.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
All right, let's move on. Kim Jong-un's North Korea last week claimed to have detonated a hydrogen bomb. In fact, not just any hydrogen bomb, but a hydrogen bomb capable of being launched on North Korea's increasingly accurate and effective ICBMs with a range that could reach the United States. The global and American response to this announcement has been chaotic and anxious. The world generally, of course, condemned it. China, which is North Korea's sole lifeline, only and best friend, condemned it and grumbled, but you know, has not done anything. President Trump, who was at the time,
they did. They signed on to some sanctions package.
Whatever. Okay. President Trump, embroiled in a separate cyberbullying of South Korea, he was threatening to cancel a free trade agreement that we have with South Korea. Issued some nonsensical Twitter threats to cancel all trade with anyone doing business with Kim. And also, we also had a lot of irritable condemnation, Security Council meetings, et cetera, et cetera. What no one seems to know is what to do. Are we going to go to war and endanger hundreds of thousands of South Korean and American troops and Japanese lives? No, no, thank you. Are we going to do more sanctions which haven't yet worked, and in fact, maybe even counterproductive with a country like North Korea, which seeks isolation? That seems to be where we're headed. Are we going to negotiate with murderous dictator who wants more isolation? Are we going to allow South Korea and Japan to develop nukes on their own and encourage them to do that? Again, that's kind of a no thanks. So, John, there's the adage that whereof one cannot speak, one must be silent. I sort of feel that way, not about North Korea, which we're going to talk about, but about policy matters. Like, maybe we shouldn't do anything. Like, maybe there are no good options and therefore one shouldn't act.
By the way, just if that adage were as in play as it is attractive, I like that notion, we wouldn't have a show.
No, there'd be like three or four things. Emily could speak about legal stuff. Right. It would be a show with the two of you.
Hello and welcome to Slate Silence, to the Slate Mumbles. So I think the increasingly over the last month, while the rhetoric has gotten hotter from the president, and obviously the number of, I mean, this hydrogen bomb test, 6.3 on the Richter scale, and this idea that it can be married with an ICBM, I think that's true based on what I've read, that the whole tricky part now, if in fact the North Koreans are to be believed on this, which they may not be, is that, okay, they could fire it into the air, but then the question is whether it could go through the reentry process, that's the next and perhaps
the
last
rockets go
tricky.
Up. Who cares where they come down?
Right, if it's got
that's
a nuclear
not
warhead.
My department, said
right.
Werner von Braun.
Oh, that's good. I'm sorry. I stepped on that. I didn't realize.
The Tom Lehrer song.
He kept right on going.
I guess my feeling in the last month has been that there's a lot of posturing, and basically they are trying to negotiate, both the U.S. and the North Koreans, a way to get to talks. And it involves both sides amping up their rhetoric and behavior to maximize their negotiating position and, on the part of the United States, to get them to the table. So that means the sanctions in the United Nations. It means putting pressure on China, which the U.S. believes is the only country that can basically get the North Koreans to sit down at the table, which is what the North Koreans want, but they want it on their terms. And that Steve Bannon was right in his when he let slip what is said, which is the U.S. does not have a military option in North Korea and is not in a position to enact one, as other analysts have said. Like, if they were poised to act, they would have to do a lot more stuff that they're not doing. And Michael Morell, former number two at the CIA, said they're about 45 to 60 days away from where they would need to be to do military action.
Who's the they? North Korea?
Oh, America.
Or us?
America. Okay. America. So, on the other hand, the president's bellicose talk is aimed not necessarily at North Korea, but is aimed at China. China does not want destabilization in North Korea, which means they don't want one of several things. They don't want military action. They don't want U.S. rhetoric rattling up North Korea in a way that makes North Korea do something that invites military action. So say they put that ring of fire around Guam and one of those missiles meant to create the ring of fire actually hit Guam, then the U.S. would retaliate. China doesn't want that. It doesn't want chaos. And so it's this kabuki that's going on all to get negotiations to take place. And by the way, there are back channel conversations going on between the U.S. and North Korea. It means the messages that are sent are opaque, but they exist. And there's obviously messages being sent through China to North Korea. So the hotter you see it getting in the rhetorical scale, I've started to sort of feel the rhetoric is meant perhaps in some ways to actually get you to the exit ramp, even though if you take it just at its face value, you would think, oh my gosh, we're in Armageddon tomorrow.
I kind of think you're giving the Trump rhetoric too much credit for being thought through and strategic. Like, I think he just sounded off. I don't think he was like, oh, and now it's a really good idea to threaten to end our, to accuse South Korea, our ally, of appeasement. I think he just did it.
That is totally possible. But I do think there are some things. So I guess what I would say is on the China thing, for example, when he talks about like cutting off trade. By the way, if you're going to cut off trade with countries that do business with North Korea,
that would be China. 80% of North Korea's trade.
And our largest trading partner. But it would also be Germany, Brazil. There are other countries. So it's not going to happen. But the way it's been explained to me by administration officials is that if it sends the message to China, they need U.S. trade to happen. And they would prefer it to go along the path that it's been going. So while it may not disappear, fibrillations in the U.S.-China trade relations affects their domestic economy.
Unless and until the Chinese realize that Trump sounding off is meaningless, and then they just tune it out entirely.
But I don't even understand why do we want to get to negotiations with North Korea? Like, what good does that do? We had 25 years of this.
Yeah.
The nuclear program has continued.
They've made a deal with them at the end of the Clinton administration.
Well, different leaders. And who knows if that is a deal they would have stuck to.
I think
they're rational actors. If you look at what Kim Jong-un is doing, it seems totally rational what he's doing.
And I think the administration, regardless of what they say publicly, believes that he's a rational actor. And I believe that they want to get back to basically where the Clinton team was, with different trade-offs. But the Clinton team was on the way.
Right?
Yeah, just before basically right on the eve of inauguration. I think the goal is, or the idea is that, the reason you want to deny or you want to stop the North Korean nuclear program was A, to stop North Korea from having leverage in the region, but also because they worry that, that North Korea will trade the material or information to other countries, that it becomes a marketer of this stuff to get money, to get paid for it because they need money. Now, that's at the end. I mean, we're not even at the negotiating table. That would be, you know, that's the end of a super long, hard negotiation that would require all kinds of things to be overcome that we're not even there yet. But I think that is the end. That's the reason they don't want North Korea to be a nuclear power and why simply trying to contain it has risks that they think are worth overcoming through negotiation. Now, the question is, are those risks worth overcoming through military action? And I don't think there's a lot of appetite for
that. Can we bring in the Iran nuclear anti-nuclear proliferation deal here? Because Trump is avowedly reluctant to sign the reauthorization for this. They're making noise, even though all the other countries who signed the deal think that Iran is falling through on its promises. We claim with no evidence that it's not, and seem to be on the brink of like tossing this at Congress. Congress, here's another hot potato for you. Or canceling it. And that seems to me in some ways... Well, first of all, it just seems really alarming on its own as a statement about the United States keeping its promises in line with the Paris Accord and the message that it sends to North Korea about the value of negotiating in the medium to long term if the next person could just rip up the agreement.
Well, also, I mean, I think the Iran and North Korea examples are so wildly different. Iran was never close to a bomb. Iran wants to be part of the community of nations. North Korea really does not have a strong incentive. It's the way it's structured. I mean, it would have to undergo so many convulsions in what its economy is and how it relates to the world. Its goal is to be the dangerous weasel. Its goal is not to be part of the community of nations the way Iran is. So Iran has an incentive to negotiate. I mean, your point is right, Emily, that if you strike a deal with North Korea, why would they trust that it's going to be enforced if we're going to, or why would they trust that it's going to be held to if we're going to abandon the one with Iran? I'm just saying that
the incentives were totally different.
The incentives are very different. And also Iran is engaged in the world and needs, and sanctions were much more effective. And the public opinion in Iran actually has an effect in a way that it doesn't in North Korea, because there is no public opinions allowed to be expressed. And
I agree with that. I'm just saying that if you think of these as sort of two different stages on which the United States is playing, that if you are the Iranians, who the leadership who took this political risk of signing this deal, you're hanging them out to dry. And you're also saying to Kim Jong-un, like, oh, yeah, we're a really great country to negotiate. You should definitely give up your nuclear weapons for this agreement, which, like, we may change our minds about tomorrow.
They will never give up their nuclear
weapons. No, they won't.
They're a nuclear state.
And honestly, if you know, as you said, it's a rational decision they're making for them.
Yeah. I'm sorry. This is just to go back to the Plotts philosophy of like, deal with your friends, don't deal with your enemies. We have friends in that area. South Korea is a really good friend. Japan is a really good friend. All we should be doing is being like, let's help the South Korean economy. Let's help the Japanese economy. You know, let's try to make sure that our relations with China are really calm and reasonable, and there are no mistakes there. And just not, I just think the time that you spend, this is like worrying about what your old enemy in high school still thinks of you. It's like, who cares? Doesn't matter. They're living their lives.
But if your old enemy could throw a nuclear bomb,
right, they're not going to throw a nuclear bomb. They aren't going to do it.
Japan and South Korea are asking the United States to deal with the enemy on their border who could have a nuclear weapon. And yeah, they might not use it, but I mean, you had the South Korean defense minister saying that the U.S. should put tactical nuclear weapons back in South Korea. Like, they got some view that things are dangerous over there. That's not the U.S. suggesting that, and the U.S. probably wouldn't do that.
Why is that a bad idea?
I think it escalates things. I think it's just like,
and
oh,
then
gosh.
That, you, so we
well,
worry.
Because the idea is you want what the U.S. and the Secretary Tillerson tried this a couple months ago, where he said very clearly to North Korea, we don't want regime change. We don't want reunification. We're not trying to take you over. A tactical nuclear weapon in South Korea would be, we're trying to take
the
you over.
And the problem with tactical nukes, as I understand it, is that your response times are reduced. So insofar as there are mistakes, like, you can make a mistake very, very quickly. Whereas if you don't have them in the field, any response is going to have to be much more considered.
That makes sense.
It's why we don't have them in the backyard anymore.
But you have that in your nice gazebo, you could put one underneath the gazebo.
It's true. Very warming in the winter. A little nuclear radiation keeps you very warm.
Unfortunately, that officer that has to be down there to turn the key, it's like, that's just, you got to feed that guy. It's such a pain.
That's right. He's always groaning about his family.
What Nikki Haley said, the North Koreans are begging for war. Was that a helpful thing to say, Emily?
I think maybe not. I haven't been feeling like Nikki Haley is a super helpful presence in all of this. I you know, if you're going to have a really bellicose, saber-rattling, kind of to a meaningless degree president, I like it better when Rex Tillerson shows up and plays good cop than I do when Nikki Haley just, like, throws more coal on the fire. What do you think?
You got a lot of metaphors working.
I know. That was really painful. Someone's ears are ringing.
You know, in the end, if they get to negotiations, like, it'll all seem brilliant. If they don't, it'll all seem a mess. I mean, this is essentially the madman strategy. The president and or the president plus Nikki Haley are oh my God, they could do anything anytime. This escalation could lead to bungling into war or actual military action. We got to avoid that. While the president keeps the rhetoric and the temperature high, Mattis and Tillerson do the work with the Chinese, the South Koreans, and the back channels to the North Koreans to get this to the place where it needs to be, which is talks, and then talks that would be fruitful. So in that context...
Sure, go ahead.
Well, right, in that
say
context...
Say they're asking for war.
Say, anything you want over here. The problem is that you miscalibrate. And also, I think it's really important for those of us who are trying to report on the administration and for everything I've said that, you know, just because somebody in the administration says, look, this is our two-track strategy, doesn't mean that that's the way it's being heard or experienced on the other end. So the madman strategy relies on two parts. One, the madman, and then the rational guy. So Nixon, madman, Kissinger, rational guy saying, hey, you know, you got to talk to me and we got to work something out because he's crazy. And then you have Kissinger working it out and it gets worked out. So, but both things need to be happening, and we don't know the extent to which both things are happening. You know, you want them to overread the president's desire to take military action in some ways, but how do you calibrate that? Like, you know, if there's a wolf at the door, like, I think there's a wolf at the door. I mean, I'm going to take action. So it's obviously super high risk.
Politics has never been stranger or more online. Which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, now let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're having... A back to school, extremely alcoholic beverage in the Bazelon Den. Emily, what are you going to be chattering about?
I want to talk about a new study that's coming out this week from researchers at the University of California, San Francisco. It's a rare piece of good news for abortion rights advocates. It's a big study of about 20,000 patients, and it compared women who got abortions in the kind of standard in-person visits in a clinic to women who got abortions through telemedicine. And that usually means that the woman herself might be at the clinic, but the doctor might be over the phone or kind of video conferenced in. And when the health outcomes of these two different kinds of patients were compared, the women who received abortions through telemedicine had the same kinds of low complication rates as the women who had an in-person visit with an abortion provider. So this is a big deal in the world of providing abortion services because it opens the door to more creative ways of improving access, where if you're in a rural community and you're not near a doctor, you could have a nurse practitioner or another kind of healthcare provider connect you to the physician without the physician needing to be there with you. And it especially matters because there are 18 states that have banned telemedicine abortions, citing health and safety risks. So this study really flies in the face of that kind of response. And it's by Dan Grossman and, like I said, some UCSF researchers.
All right. John Dickerson, what is your chatter?
So I have both a little interesting fact, or maybe not interesting anyway, and then a chatter. So the fact is that GPS data showed that the Earth's crust flexed under the weight of all the water from Hurricane Harvey between 1 and 2 centimeters.
What does it mean for us to flex? Is that like good? Like, well, you're exercising your ankle?
No. The Earth's crust can flex, but it's a sign of how much water there was, and then apparently the Earth's crust can flex and it's not permanent, but I mean, it could be bad if it flexed and then didn't
and
bounce
stayed.
Back. But apparently it operates kind of like a mattress. So I think it's going to be okay. But just as a it doesn't do that when there's a heavy truck.
It just is
a sign of how much water there was. Anyway, and then my actual chatter is about something that's happening on next week. It's called the New Center Project, and it's part of the No Labels Foundation. They're unveiling it on September 11th, and then there's a 2-day symposium in New York with where they're going to talk about these ideas. But the idea of this New Center Project is ideas to recenter America. Bill Galston from Brookings and Bill Kristol from the Weekly Standard are heading it up. And it's basically two people who are, you know, at different times in their career have been severe partisans. Bill Kristol writing the memo about how to destroy Bill Clinton's attempt at universal health care. Galston worked, you know, has worked in Democratic politics for a long time. And it's their effort to get together and take on the 6 big issues from a kind of center position. So immigration, trade, tax reform. Everybody should read this thing they put out, not because you would agree with the ideas, but it just seems like in these times, these moments now, where everything is fought in such extreme terms, this is a it's just nice to see this happening somewhere.
You're glad that people are crossing any sort of ideological divide whatsoever. May they all hold hands forever.
Exactly. And so I realize that puts me in the difficult position of being in a kind of kumbaya goo-goo moment. But I feel like that's not a bad thing to at least have on the plate of your political diet. Because right now, what is on the plate is basically all pretty grim. And so if for no other reason, reading this is and also, by the way, when you talk to voters, there are those that you talk to who are super partisans. And then there are those who say, you know, if both sides could just get together and, you know, work it out and trade off and recognize that things are complex and recognize that, you know, a lot of the political conversation about policy is based on demagoguery and not based on, you know, that's what this document seeks to. So, and then finally, it's actually not a bad document to then say to people who have views that are on different parts of the spectrum to say, okay, but why is your idea better than this one? Just as a way of, you know, perhaps demolishing these ideas in the center. But that itself is quite useful because it defines policy to me in a way that kind of moves it out of this craziness we're in at the moment.
We have a venerable, there are no venerable traditions to the GABFest. We're not that venerable, but we have a
you're just pretending that we're not old, but we're actually old.
We have a tradition that we're proud of at the GABFest, which is that our researcher on his or her last day as our researcher will do a cocktail chatter. And today we have the good fortune to have Kevin Townsend, who's been our stalwart researcher for the last year or so. Kevin could have been on the show 100 times. He could have hosted the show 100 times. He's an incredibly smart, interesting person, as you're about to learn right now. Kevin, what is your chatter?
So I'm going to take the opportunity and do 2 kind of related chatters.
Oh, you and John are double-dipping this extra bit. Go ahead. You've earned it.
I'm prorating my chatters.
That's right.
Based on tenure. So the first quick one is the work of Nikki Case, which I just discovered yesterday, actually, who I'd best describe as like an indie game designer who does these quick like 20-30 minute explainer type things for complex systems. So I found this one. You can find it at ncase.me/trust. And it's basically a way of like playing out and learning game theory in this really like simple, beautiful, fun, cartoonish way.
Oh, that sounds great for kids.
It's
perhaps.
Really good. Yeah.
And grown-ups.
Yeah, kids and grown-ups. I mean, I
really kids of all ages.
Kids of all ages love game theory.
We know some of them.
Yeah. But I mean, I studied game theory and I studied economics, but it was still like fun and you learn something through it. And it's a great way of having this simple little fun thing. And the rest of his work, I mean, I think initially he got attention years ago for this game he created that was like a text adventure game called The Coming Out Simulator, which I actually played for the first time yesterday, which is you play as him coming out to his conservative Asian parents. And as someone who's never had that experience, it was a way of like getting invested in the decisions because you're making decisions about what to say in what moment. And he has a great little explainer talk that he gives at the Long Now Foundation about how using games to explain complex systems is a fantastic way of puncturing it in and spreading it to a broader audience.
That's awesome.
I just love that.
Hey, man, what a great chatter.
Yeah. Really,
yeah, and now you're going to do chatter. Another one?
I think, you know.
Bring it on.
That's great.
Well, on the idea of, on the thing of complex systems being simply explained, I have that Neil Irwin piece in the New York Times, headline of which is, "To Understand Rising Inequality, Consider the Janitors at Two Top Companies Then and Now."
Or The Tale of Two Janitors, as it started going around on Twitter.
In this piece, Neil took two janitors, one Marta Ramos, who works at Apple currently, and one Gail Evans, who worked at Kodak a few decades ago. Evans rose to become an executive in the company. Marta Ramos essentially has no upward mobility within the company. She's a contractor. Wages are fairly set, and there's not really much opportunity to
Apple
rise.
Apple would never know what potential she has beyond what she's doing now.
Exactly, exactly. And I mean, structurally, like this is something that this is a format that isn't too unusual to take anecdotal cases to explain something complex. But I thought it was a really well done example of that, and done in a way for an issue at a time that I think is really, really worthwhile right now. The structural labor problem, how we're going to not just address inequality, but address the underlying structural problems of how we're getting to be a less and less labor-intensive economy overall, and people are being left behind, is an enormous problem, and one that I think is hugely salient right now, especially. I think our politics is not very good at dealing with these gigantic problems when there's not really a resolved way to solve them among experts. My mom's a labor economist. She literally, I grew up in Pittsburgh. She did her career-making work on labor in the steel industry. And then I moved to Palo Alto and like saw sort of the Rochester, Cupertino sides of it. And I talk about this with her often, and it's something that is a huge problem that they just do not have a solution for right now. And I think there's not an easy way for politicians to speak about big problems that people feel and realize are there without being able to offer solutions. That maybe partly explains some of the backlash against expertise and some of the feeling that like they're being talked to and talked down to, right, that these problems need to be resolved but aren't being addressed directly, and the lack of a solution isn't being addressed and being openly spoken about.
I'm a big fan of Neil's generally. But one other thing I really liked about this piece is that the narratives made you care and will be much of what I remember, but it was backed up with a lot of numbers and other kinds of evidence about the difference of these companies and the facelessness of subcontracting, right? The idea that Apple can subcontract all these, in this case, I think it was mostly janitorial jobs they were focusing on, but there are lots of other kind of subcontracting. And then essentially the company is immune to direct criticism. One of the reasons Kodak was more generous in its benefits plans and its idea of employee mobility was that everyone worked for Kodak. And so they were kind of, the company owned their employee interests and values in a different way. And that was just a really striking feature of the disparity that Neil was putting his finger on.
Yeah, I mean, through the anecdote of these two janitors, he's able to talk about all these different moving parts. I mean, it's not just about these different industries. It's about their HR practices. It's about like corporate structure more broadly, all of these kind of coming together. And I do think it does a good job also of not completely casting Apple as the villain in this.
Right. Apple was making cost-saving moves that were perfectly rational from a corporate standpoint, but they do have this this collateral consequence.
Yeah, absolutely.
My chatter today is about a fantastically interesting website service that I learned about from a CNN article, although then it turned out that, just to toot our own horn, Atlas Obscura had in fact written about it before.
All right.
CNN.
On it.
So it's called What Three Words. And it turns out that one of the big problems with package delivery, with sort of finding people, with doing e-commerce in the world, is that there are very few addresses in the world. Places like, you know, New Haven, Connecticut, or Washington, D.C., people have addresses. They're well mapped. They're easy to find. But in a lot of the world, that is not the case. And this company called What Three Words has done something brilliant, which is they have divided the entire planet up into a 10 by 10 meter grid, or maybe it's 3 by 3 meter grid, 10 foot by 10 foot grid. With millions and millions and millions of 10-foot by 10-foot squares. And each of these 10-foot by 10-foot squares, they have given a unique three-word address. And so that three-word name, it's very easy to store this data on a phone, even every address in the world. It's a tiny amount of data to keep all that information, allows you to essentially reach any place in any spot in the world. And so now the country of Ivory Coast has just gone to this as its addressing system. The country of Mongolia went to it as its addressing system last year, which is, I guess, what occasioned Atlas writing about it. And it's brilliant. And so, for example, the Slate office we're sitting in today is Garage Rice Goat.
So it has nothing to do with the actual address.
Nothing at all.
Like,
nothing at all.
No word, no number that's associated with the street of L on which we actually sit.
Yeah. Yale Law School. Yale Law School is Busy Capes Scale.
It's excellent.
New York Times is Mimic Hiking Album. the Slate office, actually, I can't tell if this is Slate Brooklyn or Slate DC. I'm not sure. It's Chairs Armed Cars. The Trump Hotel in DC, Votes Blocks Behave, which is a great one.
That's hilarious. Are they randomly generated? Did you say that?
I think they're randomly generated. Yeah.
They seem randomly generated.
The Trump Tower in New York is Deaf Gone Shall.
Oh, maybe they're not randomly generated.
The Capitol building is Gosh Casual Stale. The Washington Monument is Congratulations Fingernails Desk.
This is excellent.
The Atlas Obscura office is Smiled Scans Strong.
You could go on at
you
length.
You could go on forever. You could go on forever.
Literally.
My house is Cared Dark Spoke. So if anyone wants to find out where my house is, it's at Cared Dark Spoke. And you can go to whatthreewords.com and put in any place on the planet and figure out what it is. But it's just a brilliant technological solution, which also is just like very earwormy.
That's so great. So is like FedEx and every other package delivery service, could they all use this? Sure.
Presumably they could all use this.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's so cool. I like how it has no numbers too.
Right. Right. Although it is very Anglo-centric.
That's true. And I guess also it doesn't tell you what you're near, right? Cared Dark Spoke isn't next to Cared Dark.
That's true. I, you know, I didn't look whether they do.
Yeah.
Do anyway. That. That's an interesting question. Probably it doesn't. Probably they're not connected like that. Yeah. Interesting. Before we get to credits, I want to say a good word or two or seven about another podcast that you should be listening to. It's a podcast I listen to every week. It is my number one must podcast. Maybe number two, actually. I should say that because I listen to this British soccer podcast. Number one.
Oh, yes,
but my number two.
That out.
My number two is Hang Up and Listen, which is the Slate sports podcast hosted by the wonderful Josh Levine and Stefan Fatsis. It is sports talk for people who aren't interested in kind of game scores, who want just a really, really, really smart, counterintuitive, slatey take on the world of sports. And you don't actually have to be much of a sports fan to care. I'm not even that much of a sports fan. It's just fascinating. Josh and Stefan both have such an interesting mind about sports, and they're so analytically rigorous. And they interview incredibly interesting people. One of my favorite things they did last year is they interviewed this, I think he was a high school football coach who never punted.
Oh, I remember that. That was genius.
It was genius.
It was great.
Yeah. And he did an onside kick for every kick. And it was sort of like he had a whole strategy and it really made sense. And you thought, well, everyone in football may be doing it wrong. This guy he's got a whole take. And Josh and Stefan did a great interview with him. You should try to listen to Hang Up and Listen, which is post Monday evening comes out. So add that to your diet of podcasts. That's the GabFest for today. The show is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher, Kevin Townsend, today hands over the GabFest baton, which is a panda shinbone electroplated with titanium. He hands that baton over to Izzy Rode. Kevin, you have done a fantastic job. We are thrilled to have you. Thrilled to have you participate on the show today. And we're going to miss you and great good luck in your future endeavors, which is right now producing the podcast for The Atlantic, producing a rival podcast.
Yeah, we look forward to being outdone. That's what's going to happen next.
Exactly. Izzy Rode is now our researcher. You should follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. Really helps when you follow us on Twitter. It allows us to engage in conversation, hear from you, share thoughts and ideas. And it's fun. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. And please get tickets to our Chicago and Boston shows if you're going to be in Chicago on October 25th or in Boston on December 6th.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.